Thanks, Walter, and thanks for the organizers of the symposium. And unlike many of you here who talked this morning, I have not worked in Wendell's lab, nor have I collaborated with him in science, but we have collaborated in ping pong, and we were the doubles team for a number of conferences over the last several decades. Nevertheless, despite not working with him, Wendell's had a significant influence on the work in my lab. In the early 1980s, Wendell and his lab discovered a delta 11 desaturase that was involved in pheromone production in many moths. So the combination of delta 11 desaturation and chain shortening counts for many of the moth pheromones, as you've seen in several papers this morning. Well, we decided to go longer, do delta 12 desaturation, and rather than chain shortening, we do chain elongation. In the 1980s, most biochemistry textbooks said something like, animals aren't able to perform a delta 12 desaturation, therefore require linoleic acid in their diet. And the concept was that everybody desaturates here, plants here, and animals there. And several students working in my lab discovered that a number of insect species could make linoleic acid, and they had a delta 12 desaturase. The reason for this, we don't know for sure, but in those insects that don't have abundant amounts of linoleic acid in their diet, they tend to have the ability to make linoleic acid. And about 30% of the insects we looked at, of the 52 species, can make linoleic acid. So now the textbooks now say, this is our contribution to the biochem textbooks, mammals lack the enzymes to reduce double bonds, and hence mammals cannot synthesize linoleate. Well, chain elongation, we spent a number of years looking at hydrocarbons, and still do, and these tend to be from 21 to about 70 carbons long. And we've had a lot of fun with these over the years, and they perform a lot of important functions, especially in chemical communication, where they function as sex pheromones, nestmate recognition. Vitko was talking a little bit earlier about some of the roles they have. And we've been very interested in the biosynthesis of these components, and we've looked at these elongation reactions, and particularly how these methyl branches are put in. And this has been a long time ago in its history, but there's one step that, until very recently, we did not understand. And this is the final step that converts a long-chain aldehyde to hydrocarbon. For the first time, I'm going to unveil today how this works. The controversy was like this. Claude Accoudy and his coworkers presented four papers between 1984 and 92 that said that this step was a decarbonylation, gave off carbon monoxide, and no cofactors. We published a series of papers in the mid-90s that said it was a decarboxylation, a cytochrome P450, and gave off CO2. So to answer this controversy, one needs to isolate the gene involved and see what and determine what kind of gene it really is. So we actually hired Klaus Tittiger back in 1995, and his job, before he got carried away in bark beetles, was to characterize this cytochrome P450. And he, in 1997, isolated two clones that had a lot of promise. Both were, well, one particularly, this one we call P450 hide, was much more heavily present, more mRNA in the integument than the fat body. And then we ran out of money, ran out of the ability to grow this, to express this gene, and had trouble with the assay. So for 11 years, this lay dormant until last summer. We sent the gene, the cytochrome P450 gene, the sequence, to Claude Vicker-Thomas in France. She then looks at the looks for the Drosophila orthologue of our P450 hide, and there is about 72% identity and 82% similarity, and this is the gene that makes this is our gene that makes hydrocarbon and the Drosophila orthologue. She then does RNA silencing, and look what happens. Here is the 23, 25, 27, 29. In the RNA silenced, you see none of those components. In fact, the little bit you see here is probably noise because she's running it very sensitive. And the RNA silencing, what she calculates is about a tenfold reduction, but it's probably even more than that. And she looks at several different ways of doing this. In every case, the control produces a lot of hydrocarbon. The silence does not. So Now, we think we know that this final step in hydrocarbon production is indeed a cytochrome P450 decarboxylation, and unlike the most P450s, which take an apolar substrate and introduce oxygen, making it slightly polar, we do the opposite. It takes a slightly polar substrate and makes two very apolar products, a hydrocarbon and carbon dioxide. And we are now very busy trying to express this and characterize it, complete the work in RNA silencing, which Claude is doing, and then we're also using molecular modeling to better understand this P450. However, the major impact Wendell has had on my life is when first ESA meeting I attended was in 1975 in New Orleans. And at that meeting, Wendell's competitor said that moth pheromone were derived from the diet. And Wendell said, no, they're not. And this was a packed room, and they duked it out, and we weren't sure who the winner was, but the next couple years, in the pages of science, we hear that it's from the diet, we hear it's not from the diet, and then eventually the conclusion, moths produce their own pheromones de novo. So this controversy was interesting and fun, and it was also good science. So we wanted to look for an InSync system where we could do something similar. Be like Mike, be like Wendell. And so what we did is we looked around, and one of the systems which was everything was thought to be from plant-derived precursors was the bark beetle pheromones. The first three identified were ipsdienyl, ipsenyl, and ribinol from Ips paraconfusus by Silverstein and David Wood. And because of their abundant precursors, alpha-pinene and myrcene, and the concept that animals don't make monoterpenoids, it became accepted that all of the bark beetle pheromones were from plant-derived precursors. In fact, by 1980, here's a list, a partial list actually, of the pheromone components in bark beetles that were thought to be from plant precursors, which is essentially all of the bark beetle pheromones. Well, in fact, and then just to give you a list of publications, in fact, you cannot find a publication that says different, but here's a partial list of reviews and publications that assumed or showed that myrcene from the plant was the precursor to ipsenol and ipsdienyl in bark beetles. However, 1990, Byers and Birgerson said, well, there's really not enough myrcene in trees to account for the large amount of ipsdienyl. Some of these guys really crank out microgram amounts of pheromone. And a few years later, Per Iverson said that, showed that compactin, a statin, inhibits HMG-CoA reductase, would reduce pheromone production. And then, mid-90s, we showed de novo that they made it from acetate. JH regulates it, and then the current work is a genomic approach, microarrays expression, and characterization of each step. And this is what I'd like to spend some time on now. So this was the first data that convinced me that beetles indeed made ipsdienyl de novo. This is a corporation of radiolabeled acetate, radio HPLC, into ipsdienyl. This is males, they make the pheromone, females don't, nothing was incorporated. Let me explain though why it was so easy to look to interpret that the pheromone came from the diet. Here's a fed beetle, 98.2 mostly minus ipsdienyl, an unfed with JH treated, mostly minus. But here's an unfed beetle that had given myrcene. Notice it makes a racemic mixture of ipsdienyl. But prior to 1980, before chiral columns were readily available, this would have been tough to separate. And so people would see one peak here and see that myrcene went to ipsdienyl, and it does. It's just that most of the pheromone is indeed made de novo. So by 2000, it's now recognized that most bark beetle pheromones, including ipsenol, ipsdienyl, are made de novo. And there are still two examples, the products of alpha-pinene and of N-heptane, that are probably made by plant precursors, and the InSync just does a hydroxylation of a plant precursor. I say probably because it's hard to prove that it's not made, although there's no evidence that it's made by the beetle. Put this picture in to show you my role in this project. I do the first part and the last part. I cut the trees, that allows us to get the beetles, and we take them to the lab, and then I get to talk about the results after they're done. In the meantime, there's a lot of hard work going on. This particular day, our wheelbarrow had a flat tire, as did our dolly. We were on the Lake Tahoe, we weren't allowed to bring our truck into this meadow. So we had to move these chunks, 300-400 pound chunks of wood. And this is Klaus Tittiger, who's responsible for much of the work I'm gonna talk about. Matt Ginzel, first day on the job, comes from Illinois at less than 1,000 feet to 7,200 feet. And we tested him. We tested his mettle that day, and he came through. Chris Keeling and Maury Yao are watching the work going on. But you see how difficult this was. So finally, one of our grad students, Anna Gilk, says, enough of this. And she grabs that log, picks it up, and carries it out to the truck. And we get our logs loaded on the truck. So next job is where's the pheromone made? Now we know it's de novo. And what we did is we assumed, well, we didn't assume, we showed that JH and feeding would upregulate pheromone production. Julie Tillman, Fong Liu, and Steve Seibel were heavily involved in this. And we then made the assumption that if this was an animal, HMG-CoA reductase would be a key enzyme. So we assumed this was the enzyme, and we characterized this and did northerns to show us that indeed it was upregulated with either feeding or with juvenile hormone. With that, then, we could do in situ hybridization, and what we see is that the midgut of the bark beetle is the site of pheromone production. We could take isolated gut tissue and show again that the midgut is where what lights up is where the HMG-CoA reductase is. And then we could take isolated midgut tissue, incubate with labeled acetate, and show that the radioactivity was associated with ipsdienol. Same thing with another Dendrocnus jeffrey, the jeffrey pine beetle. And then Jim Nardi at Illinois did some helped us with some, or did the electron micrographs. And we see in JH-stimulated or fed male beetles, the abundant smooth ER, which is associated with lipid synthesis or an isoprenoid, and this occurs in all the midgut cells, suggesting they all make pheromone. So, which genes are involved in pheromone biosynthesis and which genes are regulated? And here, functional genomics, Klaus Tittiger and his lab started this work, and we've collaborated on it, but he's the main force here. We assumed, well, here are the mevalonate enzymes, and all of these genes, except for this one, were present in a microarray, as ESTs, in ESTs as TUGs, and then in a microarray analysis, we could look at a bunch of genes that were upregulated, some downregulated, and a whole bunch of others that weren't affected, but there was one group of cluster right up here of rapid, heavy responders, and these included many of the mevalonate pathway genes, along with a few others that we're going to look at in a little more detail in a couple minutes. So Chris Keeling then did real-time PCR, and both males and females, all of these mevalonic genes are upregulated except this one, adrenal diphosphate synthase in females. Females don't make the pheromone, males do, and despite it's an incompletely evolved system, so it's still upregulated in females, although males make the pheromone. But if you look at the basal levels, this is male to female to the log 2, males have much higher basal levels of all the mevalonic pathway pheromones. So what this allowed us to do then is we now knew that the pheromone was synthesized in anterior midgut, it was induced by feeding or JH, and basal expression was higher in males than in females. This allowed us to look for some other genes that might be involved. One of the reasons why it was thought that beetles could not make their pheromone de novo is that this adrenal diphosphate synthase, which is involved in monoterpenoid synthesis, was thought to be restricted to plants. And so Anna Gild, by PCR, about two months before we had the microarray data, isolated a adrenal diphosphate synthase. She expressed this in bacterial cells. If you look at this is GPP made by male midguts and by the recombinant adrenal diphosphate synthase. So this is the enzyme then, the monoterpenoid, the adrenal diphosphate synthase that's required for monoterpene synthesis. What most animals do is they make C15 and C20, and here we're getting a C10. She, with the help of Bill Welch, modeled this. This is the beetle GPPS, this is a X-ray crystallographic structure of an avian FPPS. You overlap them and you see there's a lot of similarities, a little difference around the active site. And if you look at the active site closely, I am told by Bill and Anna that you can tell that the FPPS has a larger site here that can readily take another five carbons, where the GPPS cannot. We spent then about 2 years looking for myrcene synthase. Seibel and his group had shown the activity of it in the midgut of Ipsepinae, and we could not. We had an FPPS that looked interesting, but it turns out the same enzyme, the geranyl diphosphate synthase, also converts geranyl diphosphate to myrcene. And I've had a 35-year-long history interested in hydrocarbons, and now we think we know how they make long-chain hydrocarbons and how they make short-chain hydrocarbons. And so this is then this just shows the activity. If we put in the labeled IPP along with DMAPP, we get both the geranyl diphosphate made and myrcene made. And the fact that we see only about 10% of much myrcene suggests that the geranyl diphosphate leaves the enzyme, comes back in a different format, and then is converted to hydrocarbon. So the next step in pheromone production is the hydroxylation of myrcene to ipsdienol. Until a year or two ago, we thought this was the last step in pheromone production. But Pamela Sandstrom, working in Klaus Tittiger's lab, isolated and expressed the P450 from Ipsepinae and from Ipsconfucius. The reason she did both is Ipsepinae makes a 95 to 98% minus. Ipsconfucius makes a 10% minus. Yet they both make about an 85% minus product from the expressed P450s that we think are involved in pheromone production, and with the Ipsepinae midgut microsomes makes about the same as the isolated gene, suggesting this is indeed the gene that does this. And so we looked at an old paper from Desiree Vanderwill from 1992, and Desiree suggested that what really goes on here is the ipsdienol there's a P450 that makes ipsdienol, then it's converted to the ipsdienone, and it's the selective reduction of this that gives the final enantiomeric composition in bark beetles. And tomorrow morning, so we're looking at the basal mRNA levels. This is the GPPS myrcene synthase. This is the P450, and this is the dehydrogenase that Ruby, Figueroa, Terran isolated. And tomorrow morning at 8:02, she's going to tell you all the details of these last few steps. But let me just summarize right here and tell you that the P450 makes a 85-15 minus plus mixture, or here 81-19. Then this is converted through a ketone, and then finally a reductase that's incredibly specific that she's isolated and cloned. And in fact, this enzyme and this enzyme are on the same protein, and it makes a 100% minus ipsdienol. Also, this was so much fun to do in Ipsepinae that Klaus has now started a genomics project on the mountain pine beetle, which is a real problem in Colorado and the British Columbia and at times around here. And tomorrow morning at 8:26, he's going to update you on this genomics of the mountain pine beetle. But just to give you a little bit of a hint, this HMGR, which is probably involved in frontalin synthesis, is upregulated mightily in males that are fed with females. So, conclusions. Some insects can make linoleic acid, which we now know and recognize. A P450 is involved in hydrocarbon production for long-chain hydrocarbons. Most bark beetle pheromones are made de novo. Genomics is a great tool. In fact, genomics is almost like using Drosophila. It's almost like cheating, because once you sort of know the answer before you do the biochemistry and molecular biology. And these techniques are now being applied to the mountain pine beetle. A lot of people have been involved. I'm not going to go through the names, but other than to say that my favorite new collaborator is Claude Vicker-Thomas, with her help with the work on the P450, and Klaus Tittiger is heavily involved in all this as a main collaborator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. Questions? Colby, probably designated. Question.
So you've shown decarboxylation is involved, but can you dismiss 100% that decarboxylation is not involved?
Sure, why not? the question is, we've shown that decarboxylation, P450, is involved. Can we completely rule out decarbonylation? And I guess my best answer to that is, several years after we suggested it was a decarboxylation in houseflies, Claude Acuti called me and we talked about this, and he said, what are the possibilities? Well, he said, what I think is happening is that you have a P450 that oxidizes the carbon monoxide to carbon dioxide,